From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Ohio just won't go away. The state that gave George Bush the 2004 presidential race that continues to haunt the left-leaning who think the election was rigged, that is bound to be a battleground state in 2008, is brimming with problems right now.
I want to publicly apologize today to this court and to people of Ohio for my failure to file complete financial disclosure reports as required by Ohio law. I accept full responsibility for this mistake, and I am very sorry.
The state's Republican governor, Bob Taft, pleading no contest last week and guilty on ethics violations. A major GOP fundraiser caught with rare coins and state millions missing. A fiercely Republican district almost voting a Democrat into Congress this month. And a terrible, mood-changing death toll of Ohio soldiers in Iraq. This hour on Point, the GOP's Ohio problem. You can join the conversation. Are you keeping an eye on this fabled political battlefield? Is Ohio signaling a national change in the political weather? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We begin with two top reporters for the latest in Ohio politics. Alan Johnson covers the Ohio Statehouse for the Columbus Dispatch newspaper. Alan, thanks for being with us.
Certainly, Tom.
And Sandy Tice is Columbus Bureau Chief for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Sandy, thanks for joining us.
Nice to be here.
Sandy, first to you, if I may. What is the political weather out there? There's a lot of things piling up here. Is it getting weird? Is it getting shaky for the GOP?
It's getting both, actually. And we're not only hearing from the political people, we're hearing from the voters. Every day I get in and my voicemail is almost 80% full or more than 80% full. And the voters out there are just outraged because they feel as if their money is being stolen, and that's never good for the party in power.
Not at all. Alan, Ohio, of course, played a huge role in the 2004 presidential race. Is it possible that the basic chemistry of this state is changing?
I don't think the basic chemistry has changed. I think that it was always and has been for quite a while kind of a toss-up state. Last year, I believe a lot of Ohioans were persuaded by the president's argument about if you don't, we don't fight them over there, we'll be fighting them over here. I think that shook up a lot of people. But now, in Ohio particularly, things have changed for all of the reasons you very adequately outlined in the introduction to the show.
So a swing state doesn't take that big a change to change the way the weather vane is pointing. But we wonder, Sandy Tice, help us. We want to walk through these four elements, at least, that we see here. Bob Taft's plea of no contest last week. These allegations are not exactly big money, but the state seems very upset about them. Remind us, what's at issue there?
Well, we have a law that says if a politician accepts a gift in excess of $75, that has to be reported on the annual ethics statements. And the governor didn't report a couple dozen instances where he had accepted gifts, mainly golf outings from people. It doesn't sound like that big of a deal, but what makes it such a problem for the governor is one of the people involved was Tom Noe. And he's the coin dealer from Toledo who it appears as if he's misappropriated at least $14 million, according to his own lawyer, from some money that he was investing for the Ohio Bureau of Workers' Compensation. So connecting the missing money to the ethics violations is what makes this such a high-profile problem for the governor.
It starts to smell like scandal. Alan, what happened with the injured workers' money there and the rare coins? What's that nest all about?
Two different elements, although we may eventually find out they're connected through one man, perhaps an investment person at the Bureau of Workers' Compensation. But essentially, Tom Noe, as Sandy mentioned, a GOP contributor, fundraiser, he obtained a deal from the Bureau of Workers' Compensation that allowed him to have $50 million to invest in rare coins. That would have been unusual enough the way it was, but it turned out that he was using the money for other things, other collectibles, to make loans, a whole range of things that we've only discovered this year. Secondly, we have other questionable investments by the Bureau. One particularly was with MDL out of Pittsburgh, I believe, and that one was found to have lost $215 million. So that one really dwarfs the Noe loss if you look at it in that sense, but And those two things put together, coupled with many of the other ones, helped force the resignation of Jim Conrad, who was a very long-time trusted administrator as head of the Bureau of Workers' Compensation, and he was ousted earlier this year. Technically, he resigned, but clearly he was forced to resign by the governor, who feared a growing scandal on that agency.
So a scandal that points toward what, an aura of corruption around the GOP in Ohio, Sandy? Is it fair to say?
I think that's part of it, and part of it is just ineptitude. The Republicans always market themselves as good managers. And initially, when the first newspaper stories from the Toledo Blade came out about Tom Noe, the governor was very defensive, very defiant, said that they had actually made a lot of money and that this fund was making more than the benchmark. That turned out not to be true. And then we find out that the governor didn't know that Tom Noe was wining and dining some of his staff members. They had something called the Noe Supper Club, and some pretty influential people, including people who had a hand in state board and commission appointments, were going to dinner with Tom Noe, where the steaks were fat and the wine was fine, and Tom Noe managed to get a couple of plum appointments to state boards and commissions. It looks as if the governor really isn't in touch and didn't know what was going on within his own office.
So none of that smells good. And then in the South, I guess, was it the 2nd District, Alan Johnson, where Paul Hackett, the Iraq war vet, stood up, gave a real challenge to Gene Schmidt, a kind of a near miss. She pulled it out there, but this is more solid GOP territory than is accustomed to having a Democrat make that kind of run at the office. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. This is one of those districts that is so gerrymandered you can hardly recognize it. It's one of those districts that were drawn by Republicans, and frankly, the Democrats in their turn have done the same thing. But the Republicans drew this district, reshaped it, so it was about as solidly Republican as you could possibly get. And yet, Hackett almost pulled it off, and I think that sent some very deep shockwaves throughout the Republican Party in the state and nationally that, whoa, we may have a problem here on general principles, on Iraq, and on a lot of different things.
Hackett, Sandy, was very outspoken on the war in Iraq. At one point, even pointing to the president, calling him, if I've got this right, an SOB without the initials.
That's correct.
How did that play? Did that turn out to be a plus for him?
You know, I thought when I heard that might have hurt him a little bit. But what Alan says is absolutely correct. I think there's only one congressional district in Ohio that is more solidly Republican. They normally get token opponents who get no financial support from the party. And in this district, Max Cleland came in, James Carville came in. The New York Times covered this story on its front page.
Yeah.
This was a real shocker to the political people in Ohio.
Grover Norquist, the conservative activist in Washington, saying, if Iraq is in the rearview mirror in the 06 election, the Republicans will do fine. But if it's still in the windshield, there are problems. And, Alan, that death count out of Iraq, another major problem in Ohio.
Right. Before we leave the subject of Hackett, I haven't seen this in print yet, and I don't even know if it's true, but I've heard he may be running for a statewide office, perhaps attorney general. So Mr. Hackett may be back on the political radar. As far as Iraq, and Sandy would actually probably be a little closer to this because the recent grouping of deaths from Iraq, a lot of them came out of the Cleveland area.
Yes.
But that really, really hit Ohio hard. It's not that there haven't been funerals. It's not that there haven't been soldiers coming back in coffins out of Iraq, but this time there was a group of them. There was 16 or 20 over a matter of a few days, and it really, again, I hate to overemphasize the shockwaves, but it really shook up Ohio, and it shook up people saying, you know, this is really serious. This is not just one or two or three. This is a lot of friends and neighbors and fathers and sons and husbands who aren't coming back.
Sandy, that's in your home turf. What are you hearing in the voices of those who have lost family members, those looking on? Is there an echo of the Cindy Sheehan get out now mood there?
I was just going to bring that up. I think there absolutely is. And we had a picture on our front page right after that happened, and it was a family in the suburbs, a mom and dad with their arms around each other, and there were flags along the tree lawn. And it was this meticulously manicured suburban lawn and this very sad mom and dad walking up to their front door. And the phone was ringing off the hook that day. I think people are really starting to feel comfortable now asking out loud, what are we doing there? And that's what we're hearing up in the Cleveland area.
Alan, Sandy, we've just got a couple minutes with you here. Alan, first to you, what's your sense of what all this signals to the GOP? Ohio played a huge role in the 2004 presidential race and outcome. How big a warning signal do you hear?
I think it's big, and I'll discuss it briefly on two levels. One, clearly, very, very big concern in the state. Ohio Republicans have held all the statewide non-judicial offices for, it'll be 16 years when the current term ends. They've held the state legislature for a decade. They've held control of the Supreme Court for as long or longer. And they are very, very worried. I have never in my 16 years covering state government seen Republicans running scared like they are now. They're literally afraid of this issue. They're afraid of the scandal. They're very, very worried.
Sandy, we got half a minute here. Running scared?
Absolutely running scared. And in 2003, Betty Montgomery, who's our auditor, took a statewide poll before all of this happened and found that an unnamed Democrat would beat an unnamed Republican if the governor's race were held today. So the Republican fatigue has been out there for a long time, and now finally the Democrats have issues.
Wow, something changing here. We're going to talk what might be made of that something in this hour. Sandy Tease with the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Wonderful to have you with us. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Alan Johnson with the Columbus Dispatch. Thanks for joining us, Alan.
Absolutely.
We are talking about the GOP's Ohio problem, how big it is, how wide it is, how much it matters. Have you been following Ohio? And what's the message coming out of the nation's swing state? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the GOP's Ohio problem, a kind of perfect storm, or a storm in any case, of things coming together there lately that have not looked good for the GOP. You can join us in this hour. Is this the canary in the coal mine for the GOP, or are the Democrats crowing too soon? And is Ohio signaling a nationwide change in the political weather? Are the Democrats ready to do something with it? If it's there, we're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joined right now from Erie, Pennsylvania, just across the border, by Alexander Lamas. He's professor of political science at Case Western Reserve University, author of The Two-Party South and Ohio Politics. Alec Lamas, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
So there you heard Alan Johnson, longtime reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, saying in his 16 years he's never seen the GOP running so scared in Ohio. Do you buy it? Do you see it?
Yes, I agree with both Alan and Sandy. This is a difficult time for the GOP, but you have to remember it's unusual that one party would control state government for so long, as has happened with the Republicans in Ohio. When the next election comes next year, it will be 16 years that the Republicans have had the governorship. Usually the governorship alternates every 8 years between the two parties.
And this time, if you had to bet today, well, you've got some real challenges for the governor's seat there.
Well, we have to wait and see how who the candidates are going to be. You're going to have contested primaries in both parties for the nominations. And it also will be difficult for the Democrats to capitalize all across the board. I mean, they have to have good candidates fielded in state legislative races for the statewide offices below the governorship and judicial offices as well. So it's even in state elections in next year, you can't count on a complete sweep. But certainly it must look good for the candidates running for the Democratic gubernatorial nomination.
And let's look at the national picture for a minute here. It's worth remembering that it was not any kind of landslide for George Bush in Ohio. But, of course, the margin was all that mattered. He took it, and pretty much with that, the White House, it means the state's entire chemistry doesn't have to change. Just enough to swing the other way, it can have big national implications. Do you see that kind of change at the margins potentially in progress here?
Well, the national Democratic candidates have done a lot better than the Ohio Democrats have done. Obviously, Senator Kerry made a major effort in Ohio and came short by two point something percentage points. Even Senator Gore surprised people, Vice President Gore surprised people in 2000 when he came in reasonably close, not as close as Kerry, but then the Gore campaign had decided to de-emphasize Ohio in the last couple of weeks in a controversial move. But there's a big difference, I think, between the National Democrats' situation and the state Democrats.
Well, read that for us. How much of the fuss and trouble in Ohio is just Ohio's, and how much of what's going on there, what may be shifting, do you see as indicative of national mood?
Well, that's what, you know, we obviously don't know for sure, but the second district race indicates that Iraq may be a very important issue in 2006. And in fact, if President Bush were running for re-election this year in November, he would have a tougher time, I think, than he had last year. There's a lot of uneasiness, as your two reporters mentioned. There's just a lot of uneasiness with the situation in Iraq. People don't easily see a way out, and they're very upset at the continuing deaths of Americans.
Now, Republicans have seen this too and spoken straight to it. Newt Gingrich saying, "Any effort to explain Iraq as we are on track and making progress is nonsense," told the New York Times. He said that Republicans should make the case in Ohio and elsewhere for blood, sweat, and toil as part of a much larger war against the irreconcilable wing of Islam. What's your sense of the Ohio electorate? I know that's a big question, Alec Lamas, but if the president stops saying things are going well and starts saying they're not going so well, but we have to do this to win the bigger conflict, is that a selling line in Ohio?
It was a selling line last year in the presidential election, but you know, I don't know that it plays as well this year. I really don't have good advice for the president. This is a very difficult situation. People are seeing the kind of quagmire that we got into in Vietnam. They're seeing it in this situation, even though of course the death tolls aren't anywhere near as high. But I do wonder whether we understand Iraqi politics any better than we understood Vietnamese politics.
And, of course, Chuck Hagel, Republican senator, over the weekend saying we've got real problems here and it's not getting better. We are not winning by any means. And yet there has to be another party to that will pick up that situation and run with it. I want to begin to turn to our callers. John's calling from Amherst, New York. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Pleasure to meet you. I'm a conservative individual, and what I see is I would hold your powder if I were a Democrat in Ohio,
mm-hmm.
simply because I don't think that, you know, the Democrats offer any alternative. Now, if you look at Cindy Sheehan, she is fighting for us to withdraw from Iraq. Now, if you were to take a poll of most people, and not that I believe in polls or anything, but I would say a majority say we have to be there and we have to win. Now, positing anything different from the Democrats is an invisible proposition. No political figure who has to actually make a vote is sitting there next to Cindy Sheehan, with the exception of Russ Feingold, who now says we have to get a timetable, and that'll only happen until the end of 2006.
So are you saying, John, no matter how bad the aura around the GOP in Ohio, nationally the GOP still has the Iraq War working for it because an alternative to being there is not clear?
I'm not going to look at this politically because no one benefits from having a war. But the thing is, if you have to have an alternative, at least George Bush is saying there, and you can look at him and believe that he believes in what he's doing. When you look at these Democrats, it's always, well, let's have another plan. Let's throw more people in there. And these are kind of irrelevant to the fact. You talk about just your professor here, this quagmire of Vietnam. There is absolutely no comparison to Vietnam. I am never going to believe it, because what you have in Vietnam was you had an ideology, communism, fighting against free people who wanted to have democracy.
Well, you may be right, but of course there is an ideology at work in parts of the Middle East here. I mean, Osama bin Laden's got an ideology, and you've got even Republicans now sort of beginning to bring up the Vietnam dynamic. But let's put it to our guest, Alec Lamas. How about it? Two issues there. One, John saying the president's belief in what he's doing still stands front and center. What about the president's credibility? And secondly, how do you see the Democrats responding to this sort of shake and bake in Ohio? Do they appear to have an answer, an alternative?
Well, on the first point, I mean, the president's credibility is clearly eroding. I mean, his approval ratings are now running roughly in the mid-40s. At the time he won re-election, it was close to 50. And they appear to be going down. And, of course, you might want to bring this in later, but there are a number of domestic issues that are working against the president as well.
Let's hear it.
First of all, I mean, people are outraged at these high gas prices, and of course they link the Middle East and Middle Eastern oil to gas prices, and though there's no rational connection here, people say, my goodness, we spend hundreds of billions of dollars over there, and what do we get? An extra dollar a gallon of gas. So that's not good. And then of course the president started off his second term talking about a fairly radical change in Social Security, and that went nowhere in the public. The figures are overwhelming that people don't want to mess with a system that they're very comfortable with. And we could go on. The economy, appears to be reasonably good, but then there are these huge deficits, and that's unsettling. And then the big trade deficits. So I think when you look towards the future of the National Democratic Party and Republican Party, you have to factor in these other domestic issues.
And right down the line, you've got Howard Dean and Nancy Pelosi and Rahm Emanuel on the Democrat side all saying great signals out of Ohio. Republicans not so sure about that, but not pleased. I want to turn now to Alexandria, Virginia. We're joined from there by Frank Luntz. He's a pollster and communications consultant at Luntz Research Companies, the long history of working for GOP candidates. Frank Luntz, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure. I apologize. I'm in an airport, so if the listeners hear children screaming or planes taking off, this is America.
We're happy to hear children and planes who can get away from them. What do you think of the signals coming out of Ohio? How do you read them, Frank?
Obviously, I work for, I'm on the Republican side, and if you don't say that there's a problem, then you have to be blind. You know, you got to be honest. The fact that it was such a close congressional election, the fact that the governor has had significant trouble, the fact that Ohio used to be a 54-46 Republican state, and now it's kind of a 51-49,
yep.
Republicans have to be nervous, they have to be concerned, because they're losing some people that traditionally vote for them.
So what, when you look from that, through that prism, out toward the midterm elections, what do you see?
Well, you see a little bit of history, which is that the American people traditionally vote the party in power out after 6 years because we get impatient. We like change. It's part of our DNA. It's our makeup that we like one party in power for a little while, and then after about 6 years we get tired and we want somebody else. That being said, the only thing weaker than the Republican Party nationally is the Democratic Party nationally. You don't get elected just by saying no. You don't get elected by saying, I oppose this. You have to have something that you stand for. Republicans were very smart back in 94 when they came into power by running on that contract and on a series of items, issues, policies that the American people very much supported. I look at the Democratic Party now, and they are so negative and so shrill and basically void of anything that would make people want to vote for them.
So if the Republican contract has some credibility issues now and the Democrats still haven't put together a powerful alternate message, one wonders where that leaves us. I want to bring our callers in again. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Vince is calling from Amherst, Massachusetts. Hi, Vince. You're on the air.
Good morning. How are you?
Very well. What do you think?
Well, I think that focusing on national issues does not lead you to a good understanding of the Republicans' problems in Ohio. I think that the Republicans' problems in Ohio began with all of the stories about the very questionable activities on Election Day last year in terms of voting accessibility. And I think they were exacerbated by the fact that the Green Party managed to get a recount, which was probably, in all likelihood, financed by mostly by Democrats through the Internet. And I think that that recount exposed problems at the county level. And actually, I think that the Republicans' problems in Ohio is not just that they have problems with people at the upper level of political representation in Ohio, but that the recount and the what the very questionable activities around voting helped, I think, weaken the credibility of their local organizations.
So you see trouble right down there. Let us pick that up, Vince, and thanks for your call. Alec Lamas, how about it? We've been hearing this morning about state-level corruption issues. Of course, down at that local level, the word was in the presidential election, the Republicans had it figured out, street by street, precinct by precinct. I guess two things. One, how about that machinery? Is it still in place? Is it still got the fuel in the tank? And two, whatever happened to the credibility issues around the election itself? How has that played out with Ohioans?
Right. Well, in terms of machinery, we can look at it two ways. I mean, there's the Republican machine, or the effort to turn out the vote, and certainly that is that's functioning well, and functioned well last election. And then there's the machinery of the elections, and there are a lot of problems with the way the people were handled at the polls. People were turned away and so forth. They got tired of waiting in lines, and that's a serious problem. But it's not one, like your caller suggested, that really has captured the imagination of people in Ohio or really elsewhere. It should. I think it should.
And Frank,
yeah, I mean,
you're Frank.
Let me jump in because
yes,
I spent a lot of time doing research in Ohio because if you study the demographics and the economic impact that the things that have occurred on, yes, in the local level, but through the economy, you would have known that Ohio was going to be this year's Florida well before Election Day. You cannot lose as many jobs as Ohio has, manufacturing jobs, and jobs of companies that have been there for decades that have either pulled out or gone under without disrupting the political environment, without creating a sense of anxiety.
Mm.
Ohioans naturally are conservative economically. But when the economy dips as much as it did in Ohio, of course it's going to cause some shifting at the local level from Republican to Democrat.
And yet George Bush brought it home one way or another last November. What about now, Frank Luntz? You said you've got your traditional midterm hiccup for a second-term president's party. Is that what this is? Or could this be... I mean, parties also stay in power a long time. The Democrats did. Republicans talking now about a sort of 50-year reign or more. Could this be a hiccup in the grand GOP plan?
Any Republican who talks about a 50-year reign will probably not be around for more than 2 or 4 years. Anyone who has that kind of, I don't say ego, but that kind of hubris will be turned out by voters. You have to prove in every election that you deserve either to be reaffirmed and returned or that you just haven't done your job. And the Republicans still have an advantage because of redistricting, because of an economy that, other than a few legitimate concerns the public has, such as gasoline prices, the economy is actually reasonably strong nationwide. But if you want to use Ohio as the centerpiece, I think Ohio in 2008 in the presidential campaign is going to determine the next president of the United States. Whichever party wins Ohio wins America.
And what about 2006? Just for a moment, Frank, I know we only have you for a couple more minutes. Is it at the bottom line going to be a tempest in a teacup here? Do you see any possibility of this signaling a shift in either the House or the Senate? Or are Republicans confident of continuing their majorities on Capitol Hill?
It's very hard because of the current redistricting lines. Democratic legislatures drew Democratic lines, Republican legislatures drew Republican lines because there are more local Republican officials. You really can't create a map that gives the Democrats a victory in the House. In the Senate, because of who's up, there are a lot more Democrats running in 2006 than Republicans.
Right.
It's also very difficult to see the Democrats getting a majority, but I got to tell you, I would not be surprised to see Democrats pick up a few seats in the House.
And maybe some right next door in Pennsylvania. Rick Santorum facing a challenge there from Bob Casey. Frank Luntz at Luntz Research Companies, thanks so much for being with us this hour.
It's my pleasure.
Happy travels to you there. Alec Lamas, you were about to say?
Yes. Oh, I was going to say several times we've talked about American political history and tied it into what's happening today. If you don't mind, give me a second or two, I can... go back a little bit and tell you how we got to where we are today.
I would love to do that. We've got to take a short break. If you hold the history lesson, we can't wait to get it. Let us go away for just a moment. We'll be right back. We're with Alexander Lamas. He's professor of political science at Case Western Reserve University. You can join us this hour. We're talking about the GOP's Ohio problem. Have you been following it? Our scandal, dead soldiers, and close elections, the national future. And did the GOP get too cocky in Ohio? What about nationally? Or is it still on the national pulse? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We've been talking this hour about the GOP's suddenly kind of mushrooming Ohio problem and whether the Democrats are ready to do something with it. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined this hour by Alec Lamas. He's professor at Case Western Reserve University, author of Ohio Politics and the Two-Party South. Right now, Mark is calling from Akron, Ohio. Hi, Mark. What do you think?
I called in to follow up on the Republican gentleman who was calling from the airport.
Yes, Frank Lutz. He said trouble, but the Democrats aren't ready to capitalize on it. What's your view?
I'm a lifelong Democrat and Ohio resident, and sadly, I could not agree more.
What's the problem? This would seem like the biggest target you could possibly have, the biggest opening.
It's a huge opening, but it seems to me that the Democratic Party in the state has gone missing. When I talk to other Democrats, they seem to at most just say, well, the Republicans are going down, so I guess that means we're coming up, but I don't see Democrats doing anything. It's really distressing.
That would seem like a missed opportunity for a Democrat if you've got it right. Mark, thanks for calling from Akron. Let's get a view on that. From Columbus, Ohio, we're joined by Greg Haas. He is a longtime Democratic strategist working on Columbus Mayor Michael Coleman's run for Ohio governor. Greg Haas, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
So there is the picture that we're hearing, at least in part this morning, significant trouble for the GOP in Ohio, maybe national ramifications, but the Democratic Party with a question mark hanging over it about whether or not it's prepared to capitalize on what's happening there.
Right, right.
What do you say?
Yeah, first of all, I think the observations today have been fantastic. I've had a chance to listen in for a while, and I think there have been a lot of excellent points. I think that, and I'm glad Mark got on right before I did, because it was good listening to his point, because, I think that that's, one of the fundamental problems both in Ohio and nationally is the absence of the Democratic Party backbone and leadership. And, I believe that the candidate I'm working for, Mike Coleman, who's the mayor of Columbus, is an exception to that, and his campaign has been very much about kind of having a backbone and standing up. He called for Governor Taft's resignation on Friday, and a number of kind of pretty aggressive kind of leadership kind of issues. I think Frank Luntz was exactly right in talking about the fact that Democrats have to stand for something. But I don't think it's so much about individual policy kind of stuff. It's about leadership. And going back to caller John's point about President Bush, I think he's exactly right. America felt like that President Bush was wrong on the economy. He was wrong on foreign policy. The country was headed in the right direction. But they voted for him because they felt like he had conviction.
So turn that into a Democratic prescription. You know the Ohio situation. You know
right.
the national situation. I mean, we've had, we quoted earlier, Howard Dean standing up, saying this result in the Hackett-Schmidt race, a big sign for the Democrats.
Huge.
Nancy Pelosi, Harry Reid, everybody's talking about it.
Huge.
But it doesn't add up to backbone and leadership. So what's missing?
But Paul Hackett's a great example. He was very aggressive as a candidate. He stood up and defined himself. In fact, perhaps even went overboard a little bit in referring to the president as a an SOB and a chicken heart at one point in the campaign, which I think is incredible that you have a district, perhaps a district that provided the margin for Bush's alleged victory in Ohio, a district in which President Bush ran very strong. Probably around 70% of that district voted for Bush in the general election, and yet a guy who refers to the president as an SOB gets 48% in this special election. It's a shocking result.
So, but I want to understand what you mean when you say backbone and leadership are missing. Do you want more pugnacious Democrats?
No, it's not a style thing. I mean, it's not kind of. I think sometimes, you know, Chairman Dean tends to go overboard a little bit in terms of that. I think it is more about a conviction to your policies, about really believing in what you stand for. You know, and I don't mean to slight anybody, but it's not about walking around with dead geese in a photo op. It's about, you know, for instance, looking at gun owners in the eye and say, hey, look, I disagree with you about assault weapons, but I don't want to take your gun away, and I think we got to get this country righted. Now, when you are willing to stand by and approach people from the fundamental, from what you believe, from your core values, when you deal with people at that level, people respond. And we've been far too tended, you know, we've tended far too often to read polls and react to the public in a way that is, okay, well, they're for this issue and that issue, so we talk about these two, we talk about prescription drugs, and we talk about this and that. And you know, it's left the Republicans the ability to kind of cloud those issues by having policies of their own and then stand out on the things that they really care about.
So I hear you kind of calling for tough talk, sincere talk, but not exactly Dean Heat. There's a needle to thread there. Let's hear from our callers. Lance is calling from Ogdensburg, New York. Hi, Lance. You're on the air.
Good morning. I think my concern is that the Democrats seem to have, over the last few years, have had some policy thoughts and ideas. It's just not resonating. People aren't buying it. I think of our current situation in terms of energy. And we get ANWR. We don't talk about alternative energy. Several of the people that I know who are lifelong Democrats have a thought about alternative energy. It's just not getting out there.
So is it time to follow Greg Haas's view then, Lance? Is it time for Democrats to articulate those views with much more force and conviction? Or if they do that, are they going to run up against opposition? Americans don't want alternative energy.
I think they run up against opposition and they've turned into Republican light. It's a fascinating situation. The problems seem to be so obvious that when they're described and discussed, the opposition occurs. I'm confused, frustrated, all of those things. The problems seem to be solvable. It's almost like we don't want to solve them.
The solutions seem to be out there, but it's the Republican solutions that have drawn the votes. Lance, thanks for your call. Alec Lamas, how about it? What do you see? Republican light among the Democrats in Ohio, and are they missing in action somehow? Why?
They have had a tough time. Some of their candidates for statewide office haven't been strong candidates. But if you don't mind, let me go back in time a little bit.
Oh, yes. I wanted that history lesson, please.
Take us quickly to where we are today. Sometimes it's difficult to know exactly where we're going, but you can certainly have a better idea where we've come from. The first three decades of the 20th century, the Republicans dominated national politics. They were the national majority party. Mm-hmm. And then the Depression hit, and Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal captured popular imagination and made the Democrats, for the first time since the Civil War, the national party. Now, at the same time, just add quickly, the American South was going in a different direction because the Southern politics were not dominated by national factors that caused these realignments. Southern politics revolved around race and keeping the newly freed slaves and the black population in second-class status. And all that played itself out in the Civil Rights Revolution
of the 60s. But you got 50 years of Democrats in charge after FDR.
Yes, at the national level. In the South, as I say, was a party system where Republicans weren't there. They were running on a different level.
So where's the plates now?
Well, exactly. That's what's, you know, political scientists like to talk in terms of realignment.
Mm-hmm.
And the New Deal realignment was clearly one we all agree happened and made the Democrats a majority party in Pennsylvania, in Wisconsin, Illinois, and other places, Michigan. Now, then comes another realignment that that really doesn't have a name. I call it the 25 years realignment. It started in the mid-60s, 64, 65, and it played out over 25 years, really culminating in 88, 89. And what were the issues? Well, you think back on the politics of that time, and they weren't the same economic issues that dominated the New Deal period. They were cultural issues. They had to do with abortion. They had to do with race and a white backlash that occurred in the North.
Alec, our time is short. Take us to right where we are today. Are we in the middle of another big GOP span, or do you see these troubles adding up to maybe an exit ticket for them?
Well, this 25 years realignment period actually helped the Republicans and made the Republicans not the dominant party, but it made a close party system. And we saw that in the 2000 election when we had a fairly evenly balanced party system. Then came 9/11. And I think 9/11 put the Democrats back on the defensive on some of those national security issues that had hurt them in the 25 years realignment period, hearkening back to the divisiveness over the Vietnam War, which was fought out within the Democratic Party.
Where's your bottom line? Our time is short. Are they about to shake that off or not?
Well, that's we don't know exactly where we're going. I think the party system in the nation is still fairly evenly balanced, even though the Republicans, of course, dominate or control the Congress and the presidency. But they don't control the Congress by large margins, and they didn't win the presidency even the second time in 2004 by a huge margin. 3 million votes, but it was very close, as you pointed out, in Ohio.
So maybe more flux here than the tenor of things would seem to indicate sometimes. Greg Haas, your guy, Michael Coleman, running for governor, how strong a shot at that level do you see?
Well, I think we've got a great opportunity, and I think that we're going to have one of the things I wanted to speak to is I think that we're going to have great success in Ohio in this election, and it's not just because of the failures of the state party. You know, we've kind of got a perfect storm here between what's happening nationally and what's happening in Ohio in terms of several of the scandals. But it's not just that. I mean, I think we're going to have really good candidates versus, an earlier reference to the fact that we've had weak candidates for a number of years, and I think there's a hunger for change here. So we're going to be successful here, and I think a number of states are going to have individual success based around their candidates. Whether we have that national kind of tidal wave or not, I think is very much in question still, because it's going to come back to that kind of leadership that I spoke about earlier. Where Democrats, it's not just a matter of being for something, it's a matter of really being credible and speaking and being leaders and speaking from the heart.
And that's what everybody's watching right now. With that, I'm afraid we're out of time. Greg Haas with us from Columbus, Ohio this hour. Thanks so much for being with us, Greg.
Thank you.
And Alexander Lamis at Case Western Reserve, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
I want to get a quick thought here from our On Point news analyst, Jack Beatty, who joins us from Hanover, New Hampshire. Jack, you've been listening in. I'm sorry we've only got a minute. It's been so jammed. But give us your thoughts on what you see in Ohio. Hello, my friend Jack. Are you there?
Hello, yes.
Yes, sir.
Can you hear me? Yeah.
Yes.
It's really a parable, it seems to me, about divided government. I mean, the Founding Fathers thought that there would be institutional checks and balances, that just the fact of different institutions, House would check the Senate, would check the presidency. But no, it really depends upon split parties. And what you see in one-party rule is just the inherent corruption it tends to, simply because there isn't the checks and balances don't work institutionally. They have to work politically.
And pretty soon it's rare coins and golf games and not enough accountability.
And of course, it's happened in Democratic states. Anybody from Massachusetts can tell you that. But it's one of the liabilities of being in power a long time. And the American electorate has shown a predilection in recent years for divided government. Since 1970, there have only been 9 years of unified government. And we've had three now under Bush, two under Clinton, four under Carter, and the voters don't seem to like it. And this 2006 election will be a test of that proposition. And do they want some kind of divided government. My feeling is that the 1990 census, which is the first of the computer-driven censuses, the redistricting, and Clinton, in his sixth year, actually gained seats. So maybe this business of the six-year itch that Frank Luntz was talking about, maybe that dynamic isn't working anymore with these computer-generated, defeat-proof districts.
Well, Ohio sending up flares there, and I guess evidence that you can't count on Americans to go one way forever, that's for sure. Jack, we appreciate your being with us. We love the sound of your crickets up there in New Hampshire. Thanks for joining us.
Okay.
In a moment, the latest from Baghdad on Iraq's latest push to draft a constitution. This is On Point. In Baghdad today, another deadline and another push to find agreement on a draft constitution for Iraq. Last Monday's deadline, pushed hard by Washington, was missed. Major issues have remained unresolved. Today they try it again. Barzu Daragahi is Baghdad correspondent for the Los Angeles Times and joins me from Baghdad. Barzu, what's the outcome today? Are they going to make this deadline? Is there a draft constitution now ready to go at last or not?
Well, I got to caution that you never know with Iraq and Iraqi politicians, but it does appear that there is a draft constitution that will be ready tonight to be voted upon. It does appear that they've come to some kind of agreement that they'll be announcing maybe in the next few minutes.
Is it clear how they've come down on the big issues they were stumbling on regional autonomy, on the role of Islam, on oil revenues and women?
It looks like they've come to some sort of compromise on all those positions. For example, they've agreed to call Iraq a federal state, but they've declined to sort of specify what that means. They've agreed to sort of say that, you know, Iraq's main religion is Islam, but they've not sort of said that it's the main source of legislation. The only question is, you know, will this document be approved quickly? Is there still haggling going on? It appears that some of the Sunni Arabs, some of the more hardline Sunni Arabs that were adamantly opposed to some aspects of the Constitution, were just cut out. And the dominant Shiites and Kurds went to Sunni Arabs they liked. So we'll see how that works out.
And who's been driving hardest for completion here, Iraqis or U.S. representatives in Baghdad?
Well, I think there has been some Iraqis that have been in a hurry to get this over. I would say the Shiites from the very beginning, among them, there's been a faction that's been really driving hard to get this constitution done. The sort of hardline Shiites have been saying, we've got the majority in parliament. Who cares what the Kurds say? Who cares what the Sunnis say? Let's ram this thing through. And I think that the U.S. has also been, you know, really putting on a lot of pressure to various parties here. But also the U.N., Ashraf Ghazi is here, and he's been sort of emphasizing to the Ashraf Ghazi, the U.N. envoy, emphasizing to the various parties how important it is to meet this deadline in order to be well prepared for October 22nd, which is the date of the referendum. October 22nd will be the referendum now, which is the day of the referendum on this constitution. And there's a lot of prep work to do.
And Barzu, in the 20 seconds we have left, if this kind of big compromise has been reached, what do you think? Does it solve the problems or shove them off for another day?
You know, that's a very, very good way of putting it. It actually, they're basically deferring some of the major issues. For example, on the role of religion and spelling out what this federalism means. And also, for example, very highly important issue has been the issue of oil percentages and the distribution of oil revenue. They're just not spelling it out. They're not spelling out the formula. And, you know, one thing that's really important to note that, you know, whatever they draft, whatever constitution they draft, whatever they write in this, you know, in this law.
Coming down to the wire there and here, I'm afraid. Barzu Daragahi in Baghdad, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.